Stars Over Surrey with Dave Gemmatis and John Extell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
Welcome, John. Now, later on, we'll be talking about what can be seen in the night sky for the coming month, but we'll start with what's happening in the world of spaceflight and astronomy then, John.
Hello, Dave. Well, it's a quieter month this month in some ways, in that I've got fewer items to cover with you today. But there are some really interesting topics, I hope you'll agree. You might remember, David, that last month I talked about a comet that had been detected further out than any comet's been detected before. And that was one that was coming all the way from the Oort cloud, detected around the orbit of Saturn, whereas normally it's around somewhere between Jupiter and Mars that they're found. Well, this month, I'll tell you about something that's come even further, and it was first thought to be a comet. Now, this object was detected, and it seemed to be on what's called a hyperbolic trajectory rather than a parabolic one, which is what comets would be on, elliptical, in other words. So what this meant was that it couldn't have originated in the solar system. So it therefore must have come from outside the solar system, in other words, interstellar space. So a lot of the major telescopes were turned on this object. And they decided, after all, that it wasn't a comet. The closest thing to it would be an asteroid. And it was named, well, A2017-U1, which is just a designation, but it's now been given a name. And given that it was first discovered by a researcher based in Hawaii, it's been given a Hawaiian name. So forgive the pronunciation, but it's Oumuamua. But apparently what that means is messenger from afar arriving first, which is quite poetic and quite nice. However, the studies have shown that this object is very dark red in colour, and its composition must be, you know, dense stony material or even metallic composition. But one of the particularly interesting things about it is the size of it. It's about 400 metres long, and it's got a ratio of 10 to 1 in terms of length to diameter. And it's described as a giant cigar about 400 metres long. That immediately makes you start thinking, whoa, that's a big long cigar, red in colour, coming from outside the solar system.
And made of metal.
And possibly made of metal. Could it be going back to Arthur C. Clarke's Rendezvous with Rama?
Definitely visitors.
Their description, even from the scientists, was it's like nothing we've ever seen before. So, yes, you can't help but think. But it is believed to be, you know, just an asteroid, but such a strange shape, because none of our asteroids that we're familiar with are anything like that long cigar shape. Yes, they can be egg-shaped, some of them will be roundish or odd shapes, but my own thinking is that that's probably a splinter that's been, you know, a fragment having been splintered off some larger object. Scientists do actually think that these things perhaps come into the solar system from outside maybe once a year. It's just that we've never seen one before, but as our instruments are getting better, so we are now able to discover them. If it had been a spaceship, Dave, I'm sure it would have stopped by now. It would have picked up signals from Earth. But it's now actually speeding out again of the solar system at a colossal speed, something the order of, if I remember it right, 95,000 kilometres per hour, a huge speed. So if it was a spaceship, it obviously didn't like the look of us. And who can blame it? Okay. Now, think about life elsewhere. A little bit of bad news in a way, but NASA, again, only a couple of days ago, like that last report, NASA has released a paper saying that it's rethought its previous conclusions about water on Mars, and therefore the likelihood of any vestigial life on Mars. Several years ago, the orbiters, like Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, noticed that over time, some dark some streaks on the sides of craters and other slopes darkened in the summer. and that was noticed to recur. So these dark streaks were called recurring slope lineae, if I pronounce that right. And what it was thought to be was water sludge ice, you know, water and sand all mixed together, under the Martian soil, getting warmed by the summer sun on Mars, melting and flowing downhill. But now they think it's not water that's flowing downhill, it's just grains of dust, grains of sand. Because what they noticed was that it was only on really, really steep slopes, something about 60 degrees or more, where it would actually flow. Now, if it was water, that would flow downhill, no matter what the slope. But they think because it's steep slopes, it takes, you know, with Martian thin, weak gravity, that those grains of dust and sand would only flow downhill when absolutely dry, and in the sun that's likely to be the case in the summer. So that is bad news in the sense that I suppose there is now thought to be less chance of any life, you know, primitive microbial style of life harbouring on the surface. But there is a good news side of it as well. Had there been a chance of life, then missions would have been more expensive. Some wouldn't have taken place because of the risk of polluting potential life-bearing areas. Now, you know, that risk is minimised. And the other aspect of good news is that there is still, of course, considerable amount of water ice buried in the Martian regolith, the Martian soil. And ice caps that were at one time thought to be only carbon dioxide ice are now known to contain, in addition to carbon dioxide, water ice. So there will be some water on Mars for settlers to use, explorers, when they first get there. And I suppose our theme of life on other planets, nearby planets, continues with this next topic. A lot further away, though. This is 11 light years away, but a new exoplanet has been discovered that's in the Goldilocks zone. Not too hot, not too cold, just right. A temperate exoplanet. And that's been discovered by the ESO Observatory in Chile. ESO stands for European Southern Observatory. Now, it's round a star called Ross 128. That's its catalogue number. This is a red dwarf. Red dwarfs are small stars, cool stars, but the most common type of star in the Milky Way. Now, this one's interesting because the other, our nearest star, is also a red dwarf. That's Proxima Centauri, and that has been discovered to have a planet. But Proxima Centauri is a violent star in the sense that it has lots of flares, and those are likely to have sterilised the planet that orbits around it. So life probably has never arisen there. But this star, Ross 128, is a very quiet star. And so the planet, which is called Ross 128b, which is Earth-sized, it orbits its star in only 9.9 days, so it's quite close to it, but it receives only a little bit more radiation than does Earth. And so life survives here. Let's hope that life has evolved of some kind on Ross 128b. So a more hospitable environment for the possible emergence of life. Ross 128 is actually, although it's 11 light years away, it's actually moving towards our sun at quite a speed. And in only 79,000 years, I think it is, it will actually be closer to us than Proxima Centauri. So that's a relatively short space of time in astronomical terms. So this interesting planet is now going to be a target for ESO's other very important instrument called the Extremely Large Telescope, the ELT. And that's going to start looking for signs in the planet's atmosphere, biomarkers we call them, things like methane traces that might indicate that life has indeed evolved there. Next thing to have a look at is, well, back in fact to Proxima Centauri. As I've been saying, we know that there is a planet there, Proxima b, that was discovered in 2016, and so our nearest interstellar planetary neighbour. Another observatory in Chile, like the which is where the ESO's observatories are, but this one's called ALMA, A-L-M-A, that has now discovered dust rings around that star, Proxima Centauri. One inner one, which is similar perhaps to our asteroid belt, and an outer one. Now, this will be material left over during the formation of that solar system that didn't form into planets. So scientists say that this hints that the solar system of Proxima Centauri doesn't just consist of one planet, but perhaps several. So maybe ones that are a little bit further away than Proxima b might be a little bit more favourable to life. One never knows. And we'll finish off our news report with some short stories. up at the International Space Station, they've just had another delivery of a resupply vessel. You know, the resupply vessels either come from the official Russian agency, Roscosmos, that's the Progress missions, or from the two commercial American ones, SpaceX, or the other one is Orbital ATK. And it's the latter's company, Cygnus cargo vessel, that has just arrived at the space station with 3.5 tons of scientific hardware. But in addition to all this interesting scientific kit, They must be having a birthday party or something like that up at the space station, because they've taken up lots of pizza and ice cream. So sounds like they're going to be having fun up there. That just tickled me.
Well, I guess that's what the astronauts miss the most, isn't it? It's just things like that, rather than the dry food and the stuff they have to live on.
Something like that must be quite a moment for them. When
pizza delivery, pizza man's here.
Okay. Now, NASA has just confirmed it's going to have an involvement in a very interesting mission undertaken by another country. This is Japan. And their space agency has announced a mission to Mars in 2024. But it's not to Mars or the surface of the planet, it's to the moons of Mars. It's called the Martian Moons Exploration Mission. There are two very small moons of Mars, Phobos and Deimos. In very peculiar and low orbits. Some people think that they're captured asteroids that somehow managed to get into an orbit around the planet. There's even been theories that one of them might have been a hollowed-out asteroid used as a spaceship for some race, but whatever. But this mission is going off to Phobos to land on it. Take a sample of the material from the surface and return it to Earth. So that launches in 2024. I'm not sure when the return date would be. NASA has also admitted something on the downside, I'm afraid. Its Space Launch System, which is the name of its man-rated next heavy launch vehicle, has slipped. The first launch was scheduled to be first 2018, then it slipped to 2019, now it slipped to 2020. So that's a shame. So we're clearly going to be, well, apart from relying on the people like SpaceX to with their crewed Dragon vessel to get people up to the space station as an alternative to the Russian Soyuz, the Space Launch System, which again was going to be taking NASA's manned space capsule up to the space station, that will be later. However, one of the companies that has got a contract to start to supply the space station, another commercial one, is Sierra Nevada. And their vehicle is called Dream Chaser. Now, it's a space plane. And originally, that was planned to be a manned spacecraft to take people and supplies to the space station. It's change configuration that NASA have contracted with is just for an unmanned version, but as a cargo vessel. Now, that's just had a milestone achieved in its development. It's just had a very successful airdrop, dropped from a helicopter at 10,000 feet. So it's a mini space plane, about a quarter the size of the shuttle. And that's first expected orbital flight will be in 2020. And something that I just caught sight of this morning and haven't had time to follow up, apparently the Chinese space agency have announced within the last few days that they hope to fly their first reusable space plane again in the same year, 2020. So things are really hotting up. We're going to see great change. So that's it, Dave. That's my review of what's been happening in interstellar space and in our solar system.
Well, thank you for the fascinating update, John.
The month ahead for Stars Over Surrey.
Now, John, what will our listeners be able to see in the night sky over the next month?
Okay, Dave. Well, next month is always a good month. As winter draws on, the skies darken, and that means we can get out there observing just that little bit earlier in the evening. And we're going to start to see new constellations appearing, such as Orion. And perhaps I'll talk about Orion in a bit more detail next month, perhaps. But it's certainly one of the most recognisable constellations. But things such as Cygnus and Pegasus that I talked about, and Andromeda last month, they're still visible, still good sights. Cassiopeia up there, a wonderful area to look with binoculars, look at the stars along the Milky Way. We've got Gemini with Castor and Pollux, the two bright stars that mark the heads of the twins. So some splendid objects up there, but sadly not much in the way of evening planets. Let's move on to talk about the planets and the moon. So the moon is full on the 3rd of the month. And if you're an early riser and get your telescope out to look at the moon when it's at its third quarter, that would be a few days either side of the 9th, which is the actual day of the third quarter. It's always a good sight around that time. New moon is on the 17th, so nice dark skies with no light pollution from the moon obscuring the fainter deep sky objects. And the first quarter moon, best time for looking at the moon itself in the evening, is on the 25th, Christmas Day. In terms of the planets, Mercury is both an evening object and a morning object in the same month. So for the first week of December, it's going to be an evening object, but only for the first week. But it is poorly placed, very low in the southwest, just about half an hour, 45, 50 minutes after sunset. It then moves behind the sun and reappears as a morning object from the middle of the month. So low in the southeast before sunrise. Venus, still there, but really only for about another week at the start of the month, but a brilliant morning object at magnitude minus 3.8. And of course, last month, Venus made a wonderful sight together with Jupiter when they were in conjunction together in the morning sky. So about 50 minutes before the sun is when it rises at the start of the month. Mars, another morning object, but very dim because it's at the far point of its orbit, at magnitude only plus 1.4. So that's in the east-southeast, visible from around 5 o'clock in the morning. Jupiter, still a morning object, but improving, getting higher and easily visible, very bright, magnitude minus 1.7 in the south-southeast before sunrise. Saturn, still theoretically there in the evening, but a very difficult early evening object, about 30 minutes after sunset, very low in the southwestern sky. And if you've got telescopes, then Uranus and Neptune are well placed. Certainly Uranus for the whole of the month, and if you've got good binoculars and know where to look, then that can be found in Pisces. But Neptune, definitely a telescopic object, and that's in Aquarius. But your star maps that can always be downloaded from the web will point you to where those objects can be found. Now, events of interest in December, the 13th sees the peak of one of our regular annual meteor showers. This is the Geminids. So, in other words, the radiant, the point at which they seem to come from, is in Gemini. And the good news is the moon is favourable, so it won't be too bright, it won't be blotting out some of the fainter meteors. So the theoretical maximum is about 120 per hour, but you know what that means is if the radiant is vertical, there's no light pollution and your skies are completely clear. But that is very theoretical. Realistic for our area, still pretty good though, about 20 an hour. So that's not bad. Worth getting out there in the late hours of the 13th, the early hours of the 14th would be the best time to see it. Also on the 13th, the moon passes through the Hyades cluster in Taurus, occulting Aldebaran. So that's something else to get out and see. On the 14th, Jupiter, Mars and the crescent moon form a nice triangle, low in the southeast before dawn. So that makes quite a nice sight and quite a good picture. On the 21st, sounds like a pagan ceremony, it's the winter solstice, but that's the shortest day of the year, which means it's the longest night of the year. So for astronomers, the maximum observing time, but it also means that after that point, the nights get shorter, the days start to get longer, we can think that spring will be on its way. On the 22nd, another meteor shower, that's the Ursids coming from the Great Bear, but low in frequency, only a few hours, few an hour from that one. On the 25th, actual Christmas Day, I'm sure most people have other things to do, but if you happen to have been bought a telescope for Christmas, then go outside at lunchtime, because you should be able to find the moon, even in daylight. On that particular one day is when a feature called the Lunar X becomes visible. It's just a matter of two craters' walls catching the sunlight. The craters are adjacent to one another. So the inside wall of one and the outside wall of another butt up against each other. And as the early morning rays catch them, it seems to make an X shape. Against the darkness of the floors of those craters where it's still nighttime, the sun hasn't risen yet. So you should still be able to see that during daytime. Have a look. And last thing on for December the 30th, there's a waxing gibbous moon occults the Hyades. Occulting Aldebaran. I do beg your pardon, I read that out a little bit earlier. It is on the 30th, not on the 13th. Sorry about that. Okay.
Hang on, John. What is gibbous?
gibbous, that's when it's halfway between a half moon, which is what we call first quarter, and full moon. So it's the oval shape. It's the where it's the opposite, if you like, of a crescent moon, which is halfway between new moon and the first quarter. So the crescent is the part that's dark. Okay?
Okay.
Thanks. Leaving us a three-quarter moon. Okay. It's a good word, though, gibbous. It somewhat describes my shape.
What, gibbon? No, I didn't say that.
Okay. Now, let's move on to meetings at local societies. My own society, Guildford Astronomical Society, we're revisiting Mars. That's on Thursday, the 7th of December, at 7:30. And we've got a researcher from University of London, I believe, called Rivers, Lakes and Seas on the Red Planet. That's the subtitle. The main title is The Story of Water on Early Mars. That sounds really interesting. And maybe he'll mention this idea about the dust flows that were thought to be water flows. So Thursday the 7th, 7:30 p.m, Lecture Theatre L at the University of Surrey. Free to members, but I think it's £4 for visitors, just to help cover the costs of hire of the hall. There are other societies that I normally would talk about, but they've got AGMs this month, so no public meetings. Farnham AS, who meet at Aldershot Cricket Ground on the 12th, that's their AGM, and Yule AS, who meet at Nonsuch High School for Girls, Friday the 8th of December, that's their AGM. Croydon do have a meeting Friday the 15th of December at 7:45 at the Royal Russell School, but at the moment their website just says that the title is to be announced, so we all wait with bated breath. However, I can tell you about one event that I do know about, so this is advanced notice for you all. There's a stargazing evening at Guildford Cathedral, and Guildford Astronomical Society will be heavily involved in this. This isn't in December, this is in January, but get the date in your diary. Saturday the 20th of January, 6 p.m. till 9 p.m. It's going to start with a talk by a professor from the Department of Astrophysics at the University of Oxford. That's Professor Roger Davies. And the topic is galaxies and black holes. The cathedral, who will be handling the bookings, will have the restaurant and their shop open, so people will be able to pop in, get warm. There will be children's activities actually within the cathedral itself. The cathedral lights will be off, so you know that those won't interfere with the stargazing, apart from those lights that are required for, obviously, for health and safety reasons with such a large crowd. The car park to be used will be the university's car park, so oodles of car parking space, and there will be drop-off points for disabled if you can't walk from that as far from the university car park. I'm not sure quite how they're going to do this, but they're suggesting a £2 donation to help cover costs. But the full programme and bookings, probably via the website, will be available next month. So a date for your diary. Last thing, Sky at Night on television, and that's entitled Wonders of the Night Sky. This will be broadcast on Sunday the 10th of December, BBC 4 at 10 p.m, repeated on Thursday the 14th at 7:30. And what's going to happen is Maggie Adarin-Pocock is going to talk about the science behind the Northern Lights, the Aurora Borealis, and Chris Lintott will be looking at how to navigate using the stars. And Pete Lawrence, the astro imager, is going to show us some night sky highlights. And they're also going to be talking about what equipment to buy and how to get the most from it. And Pete is certainly an expert on that, being a very expert amateur astronomer himself. So there we are, Dave. That's my look at the night sky. And, of course, we must remind our listeners to go to the website to pick up the idea of the constellation of the month. Now, last month we talked about Andromeda and Pegasus, and the previous month we talked about Cassiopeia. So I'm not going to name the constellation, but it's one that helps complete the story. One of the mythical characters heavily involved, the guy that slew the Gorgon, Medusa.
That's fantastic, John. Thank you very much. This show will be repeated on Monday night at 11 p.m. and is available after transmission as a podcast. The podcast will have more material where we run out of time for the broadcast. The next edition of Stars Over Surrey will be Friday the 29th of December.
Stars Over Surrey with Dave Gemmatis and John Extell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, why not keep up to date with the Sound of Surrey by listening live at brooklandsradio.co.uk or through our free mobile app.